With this broadcast, Columbia resumes its prize-winning series, You Are There. Authentic reenactments of historic events dramatically reported by CBS newsmen.
This is John Daly in Richmond, Virginia. On this first day of September 1807, the nation may soon learn whether Aaron Burr, former Vice President of the United States, is acquitted of treason or found guilty and sentenced to death. This is the 28th day of Colonel Burr's trial here in the 5th District Federal Court, and the climax is expected in an important legal decision by the presiding judge. Supreme Court Justice John Marshall is going to rule on a point of law on which may depend Aaron Burr's very life.
Tempers are at fever pitch in this trial-obsessed city. Richmond, like the entire country, is divided between those who believe Colonel Burr is guilty and should hang, and those who are just as convinced that he is innocent. As we reported yesterday, Judge Marshall will convene this court at noon, a few minutes from now, and rule on the motion by Colonel Burr's attorneys. The defense contends that the whole basis of the government's case is untenable, since it has not been able and has not considered it
necessary. September 1st, 1807, Richmond, Virginia. You are there.
Aaron Burr on trial for his life. CBS takes you back 142 years to the event that established a precedent for the American concept of treason. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. With all the modern facilities of radio present at the trial, and CBS newsmen reporting from the scene.
You are there.
You are there is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
Richmond, September 1st, 1807. A crowded federal courtroom and John Daly.
The government will be permitted to go on with its case against Colonel Burr depends upon the decision Justice Marshall is to make this morning. The motion by the defense, if granted, would stop the prosecution from putting any more witnesses on the stand. And if Judge Marshall rules in favor of that motion, well, then it will be tantamount to a direction from the bench that the jury acquit Colonel Burr. As you know, the court is sitting in the hall of the Virginia House of Delegates. It's stifling hot here in the courtroom, and the spectators, jammed into every available seat, are mopping their faces, waiting impatiently for today's session of the trial to resume. As usual, today's audience is made up largely of men in rough woolen shirts, trousers of homespun, with their hair tied in queues, frontier fashion. Nearly all of them are followers of President Jefferson's party, the Democratic Republicans, and they seem to be solidly behind the prosecution which is demanding Aaron Burr's life. In sharp contrast is the sprinkling of well-dressed planters and merchants in the audience. They're mostly members of the conservative Federalist Party, which has come to the aid of Colonel Burr. Now, since early this morning, Quincy Howe has been talking to members of both groups, and found that all of them are more than willing to speak their minds, so strong is the partisan feeling among the people over this trial of Colonel Burr. So now to our CBS studios in Richmond and Quincy Howe.
All the Federalists I've talked to seem to think that Justice Marshall will grant the defense motion to stop further testimony. The Democratic Republicans, of course, say he will not. They say that no matter what Marshall thinks himself, he won't dare go against the popular feeling that Burr is guilty. But that's only opinion. Let's look at the facts. The indictment against Colonel Burr charges that he committed treason by assembling an armed force at Blennerhassett's Island in Virginia and taking them down the Mississippi to seize New Orleans. According to the prosecution, this was part of a bigger scheme to take the newly acquired Louisiana Territory away from the United States, to seize Mexico from Spain, and to set up the combined region as an independent country under the rule of Aaron Burr himself. But the government struck before the alleged plan could be put into operation, and Burr was captured while trying to escape into Spanish territory. 2 weeks ago, the prosecution began putting witnesses on the stand in an effort to prove its case. But within a few days, Colonel Burr moved to stop the government from doing this anymore. For 10 days, Justice Marshall listened to debates on the pros and cons of that motion. Then, last Saturday, at the close of debate, he said he would give his ruling when the court resumed sitting today. I've just been informed that Colonel Burr is at the courthouse. He has arrived from the home of Mr. Luther Martin, his counsel, where he's being held in custody for the duration of the trial. Don Hollenbeck is with the colonel, so over to Don Hollenbeck.
Don't be worried, Mr. Burr. Did you sleep well?
We're speaking to you from an anteroom in the Virginia House of Delegates, where Colonel Burr is waiting under guard until the court convenes. He's talking now with a group of ladies and gentlemen who've come here to wish him well at this crucial point in his trial. The colonel has promised to join us at our CBS microphone in a moment. In the group chatting with him, I see Mr. Washington Irving, the popular young New York essayist. We understand he was engaged by a friend of Colonel Burr to write newspaper accounts of the trial. Well, Colonel Burr has now entered his conversation. He's coming this way. The colonel's a rather short man, slim, walks very erect, probably a carryover from his years of military service during the Revolution. As you probably know, Colonel Burr is a very able lawyer, and he's taken an active part in his own defense. Oh, Colonel Burr, sir, we have Judge Marshall's permission to ask you a few questions, if you consent.
I'm at your disposal, sir.
Well, now, as a lawyer, sir, do you think Judge Marshall will grant your motion and stop the prosecution from presenting any more of its witnesses?
He must. He cannot do otherwise without violating the terms of the Constitution.
How's that, Colonel?
Well, it's quite simple. According to the Constitution, levying war against the United States is treason. It stipulates that conviction of treason shall only occur on the evidence given in open court by two witnesses to the same overt act. Now, mark that. The act must be overt, direct, clear-cut. And there must be two witnesses. Has the prosecution been able to produce two witnesses to testify that I was at Blennerhassett's Island when the alleged act of treason was committed? No, they haven't. And they cannot, because it's common knowledge that on December 11th I was 200 miles away in Kentucky.
But, Colonel, your men on Blennerhassett's Island...
Has the government been able to prove that they committed treason? Of course not. The prosecution witnesses have offered nothing but hearsay and innuendo.
All right, Colonel, but what about the testimony of Jacob Albright?
What about it indeed? Mr. Albright, an ignorant laborer, testified that he saw 20 or 30 men bearing arms at Blennerhassett's Island on the night of December 10th. Now, could such a handful of men even dream of undertaking to revolutionize the Western territories and detach them from the United States?
Well, perhaps not by themselves, sir, but General Eaton, in his testimony, said you also counted heavily on the assistance of General Wilkinson, the commander-in-chief of United States Army forces in Louisiana Territory.
General Eaton is a discredited scoundrel, and I might add that his military title is purely self-administered. Now, Mr. Hollenbeck, consider the circumstances in which he made his deposition against me. He'd been pressing a claim for $10,000 against the government for several years with no success. But as soon as he agreed to appear against me, the government paid his claim in full.
Well, are you charging that General Eaton's testimony was bribed and perjured?
If the shoe fits, Eaton is welcome to wear it. This whole charge against me is rubbish, vicious rubbish. I'm confident that Justice Marshall will grant my motion and that the case will be quickly turned over to the jury.
And if that should happen, Colonel Burr, do you expect the jury to acquit you?
Well, as to that, I realize I'm not popular. I've been the victim of character assassination, even at the hands of President Jefferson. People are prejudiced. Still, I do not ask the jury to love me. I merely ask that they love and respect the Constitution of the United States. If they do, I shall be acquitted.
Thank you, Colonel Aaron Burr.
Not at all.
This is Don Hollenbeck returning you to John Daly in the courtroom.
Colonel Burr's attorneys, Federalist Party leaders to a man, have just entered the courtroom. There's Mr. Edmund Randolph, a former governor of Virginia. With him are Mr. Charles Lee, Mr. John Wickham, and, of course, the eminent Mr. Luther Martin. Mr. Martin was a member of the Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention. He's heavy-set, broad-shouldered, favors a careless manner of dress, but he's known to have few equals in eloquence or knowledge of the law. He and his colleagues are passing this way. Mr. Martin.
Yes?
May we have a word with you, sir?
By all means.
You may recall that we had the pleasure of interviewing you once before during the impeachment proceedings against Justice Chase.
Oh, yes, in Washington. I remember very well.
Well, sir, the government's attorney, Mr. Hay, implied in his arguments that if Justice Marshall rules in favor of your client, Colonel Burr, he may face impeachment proceedings himself.
Mr. Hayes' remarks were quite out of order. I'd call it pressure tactics to intimidate the bench.
Well, Mr. Martin, how do you think Justice Marshall will rule?
Well, I'm sure he won't yield to threats. He'll interpret the Constitution as any honest man must interpret it. He must not permit the prosecution to introduce into this country the evil doctrine of constructive treason.
Constructive treason?
Yes, sir. Constructive treason is the European theory of treason by intent and not by action. There's an important difference between these two. Our Constitution expressly defines that treason should not consist of thoughts, of words, even of conspiracies, but of overt actions. If Mr. Jefferson has his way, that constitutional safeguard against tyranny will be eliminated. He'll stop at nothing in his desire to crucify Colonel Burr. But he will fail.
Well, thank you, Mr. Martin. The chief counsel for the defense is going up the aisle toward his desk at the front of the courtroom as the hour for convening draws closer. While he was speaking, the government's attorneys prosecuting the case against Colonel Burr entered the courtroom, and they are already in their seats. And by the way, I see Ned Kalmer is talking with United States Attorney George Hay, who heads the prosecution. Go ahead, Ned Kalmer.
I'm not quite sure.
Oh, Mr. Hay, could you speak to us now? Colonel Burr has just predicted that Justice Marshall will grant his motion to block any more prosecution witnesses from taking the stand. May we have your comment on that?
You certainly may, sir. Colonel Burr has a way of permitting his wishes to influence his predictions. That tendency has put the colonel out on a limb before. May do so again today.
But what about the argument that Colonel Burr was not at Bernahasset's Island and that his men on the island can't be accused of levying war because they never resorted to force?
That argument won't hold up. If Colonel Burr's men didn't use force, it was only because the government acted before they had a chance to do so. And what difference does it make whether Colonel Burr was at Blennerhassett's Island or not? We have shown that Aaron Burr plotted against our country. And we've shown that he assembled armed men and moved those men toward the execution of that plot. Now, if that isn't treason, what in the name of heaven is?
Well, the defense says that...
I tell you, sir, if the defense has its way, it will be impossible for the government to defend itself against traitors. If Justice Marshall grants the defense motion, every traitor in our country will redouble his plotting without fear of punishment.
One more thing, Mr. Hay. Mr. Martin has charged that your disregard for the question of whether Burr was at Bernahasset's Island and whether his men actually had to resort to force amounts to an attempt to introduce the doctrine of constructive treason. That is, treason by intent. He claims that this would mean the end of our civil liberties. Could we have your opinion about that?
How very amusing. Mr. Martin posing as a defender of civil liberties. Did Mr. Martin have any respect for civil liberties when he was Attorney General of the state of Maryland? No, he did not. He persecuted his political opponents without mercy. Sir, I charge Mr. Martin. I charge Mr. Martin with playing politics at the risk of the nation's safety. And I charge him with defending an own murderer, Aaron Burr, the man who killed the leader of Martin's own party, Alexander Hamilton. Oh, pardon me, sir. I see the jury is entering, and I must speak to my colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Hay. The United States attorney has rejoined his staff. As he said, the 12 jurors have entered the courtroom. They're seating themselves in the row of chairs to the right of the judge's bench.
All right.
Justice Marshall has entered the courtroom. He came in through a door behind the bench. John Daly now has a better view of Judge Marshall than I have, so back to John Daly.
Justice Marshall is walking toward the bench. As you probably know, he is not only the federal judge of this circuit, but is also Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. He makes an impressive figure in the black robes of his office. He's a tall man, carries his head a bit to one side, and there's an expression of great seriousness on his face. The decision he is to make today must weigh heavily on him, may well be the most important of his career. That's the clerk of the court. Let's listen.
All persons having business before the Circuit Court of the United States of America, in and for the Fifth Circuit and District, draw near and ye shall be heard.
Justice Marshall nods to the prosecution and defense lawyers, seats himself, and now the lawyers, spectators, and jurymen on signal all do likewise.
Mm-hmm.
The case of the United States of America versus Aaron Burr will continue.
Bring in the accused.
As the clerk of the court motions toward a door at the side of the chamber, Colonel Aaron Burr appears, walks swiftly toward the prisoner's box, two guards beside him. There's some hissing and booing from among the spectators, but Colonel Burr ignores it, shakes hands with his lawyers, seats himself, and now Judge Marshall.
The question now to be decided has been argued in a manner worthy of its importance. Counsel on each side has been of the utmost aid to the court in forming the opinion it is about to deliver. The indictment charges the prisoner with treason in levying war against the United States and alleges an overt act of levying war. That alleged act must be proved by two witnesses. If the act be not proved by two witnesses, all other testimony must be irrelevant. Now then, the prosecution has not brought forward any witness to prove the actual presence of the accused at Benahatet Island on the date of issue. On the contrary, the fact of his absence is not disputed by counsel for the United States. Consequently, since counsel for the United States has failed to establish the overt act of treason on the part of the accused, it is the deepest conviction of the court that the motion made by the defense must prevail.
Justice Marshall has ruled for the defense. The prosecution will not be permitted to put any more witnesses on the stand. Colonel Burr and his lawyers very naturally are smiling triumphantly. The prosecution or government attorneys, on the other hand, appear to be almost stunned by the judge's decision. United States Attorney Hay is speaking in a low voice with the other members of his staff, and they seem now to be in general agreement as to what to do, and Mr. Hay is on his feet.
Your Honor, in view of this decision by the court, the United States have no alternative but to leave the case to the jury. The United States rests.
Judge Marshall's face is expressionless. He turns now to the defense lawyers, and Mr. Luther Martin, chief of the defense, has risen.
Your Honor, the defense rests.
The jury have heard the opinion of the court on the law of the case. They will apply that law to the facts as presented and find a verdict of guilty or not guilty as their own conscience may direct. The jury will now retire for the purpose of coming to a decision.
And the fate of Aaron Burr is now in the hands of the jury. Justice Marshall is leaving the courtroom. Jurors are filing out also. The judge will retire to his chambers, and in all probability, he will not emerge again until the jury is ready with the verdict. The spectators are leaving the court, going outside to get a breath of fresh air, but they're eager to have the court reconvene at any moment and to hear the final decision. Ken Roberts is out there on the steps of this imposing courthouse building, and he can and has been sampling the public's opinion of Judge Marshall's decision, meanwhile taking a sort of informal poll as to what the public think the jury's verdict is going to be. So go ahead, Ken Roberts.
John, this is one of the... Oh, John, this scene out here is really something to watch, John. People are milling around all over the square, tramping down the grass, arguing vehemently with each other. Some of them are jubilant, others are red-faced with rage. Hundreds of them were unable to get into the courtroom this morning. They've been waiting here in the broiling sun, and that hasn't helped their tempers any. Most of these people apparently intend to wait out here until the jury's verdict is in. With me, for instance, is a gentleman who says he'll stay here if it takes all night. He wears the fancy dress uniform of a general in the Tennessee militia. He is General Andrew Jackson. General Jackson tells me he was brought here as a government witness because he contracted to build boats for Colonel Burr's expedition. But he was not put on the stand.
Yes, and I'll tell you why they didn't put me on the stand, because I know that Aaron Burr is as innocent of treason as you or I.
Well, General Jackson, do you have proof of Colonel Burr's innocence?
Proof? Why, the colonel told me personally that he intended to lead an army into Mexico. He intended to liberate Mexico from Spain and make it a part of the United States. Now, is that treason? No, sir, blasted, that's patriotism.
But, General, it's claimed he meant to seize Mexico and Louisiana for himself, even make himself an emperor.
Oh, no, sir, no, no, no. Only Mexico, and not for himself, for the United States. I have his word for that. The word of a gentleman and a soldier.
The word of a murderer, the word of a traitor.
Madam, now see here,
you
madam.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself standing up for a scoundrel like Aaron Burr.
Madam, I thank you to mind your own business. I was speaking to this gentleman here.
The whole country knows what Aaron Burr was up to.
Just a moment, madam, please.
And yet you stand there.
Please.
But this man said that Aaron Burr...
Yes, but let's do this one at a time, madam, please. Now, General Jackson, you think the jury will bring in a verdict of not guilty?
If they don't, they ought to be drawn and quartered and the pieces scattered to the four winds.
Thank you, General Andrew Jackson. Now, madam,
you're... Thank you for what? For pouring that Federalist poison into your ear?
Madam, I am not a Federalist. I'm as good a Democratic Republican as you are.
Then I say heaven protect
madam,
us from your
please.
Kind of Democratic Republican.
Instead of dragging him into court, President Jefferson
General
should have stuck a medal for Colonel Burr. We frontier
General Jackson,
folk know
General,
that
please.
We'll have to fight.
If you don't
we'll
mind, sir, you've had your with... chance. Now, please give this lady her chance to speak.
Well,
thank
well,
you
but
again,
but
General. Now, madam, would you tell us your name, please?
I'm Mrs. Emily Shepherd.
I see, and do you live here in Richmond?
Yes, and a sorry place it is to live these days. Full of rich Federalists, hobnobbing with Aaron Burr, sneering at the ordinary people, scorning President Jefferson of the Republic. It's a disgrace the way they've made a hero of that man, giving great dinner parties for him, and him a traitor to his country. Why, Justice Marshall himself attended one of those parties. It's shameful, shameful.
Do you mean that Judge Marshall is prejudiced in favor of Colonel Burr?
He's a Federalist, isn't he? What can you expect a Federalist? I say it's high time they learned their lesson, and they'll learn it when Aaron Burr is hanged by the neck.
Thank you, Mrs. Emily Shepherd. Judging from what's being said out here, I'd guess those reactions from Mrs. Shepherd and General Jackson just about sum up the two opposing attitudes. Quincy Howe in our CBS studios here in Richmond has been examining the situation. He's ready now with his analysis, so back to CBS Richmond, Quincy Howe reporting.
It must be clear by now that these past 28 days have witnessed something much more than just a trial at law. What's been going on here has been a basic struggle between our two political parties, the Federalists on the one hand and the Democratic Republicans on the other. Ever since President Jefferson, leader of the Democratic Republicans, indicated his desire to see Colonel Burr convicted, the Federalists have made Aaron Burr's cause their cause. Many Democratic Republicans say that the New England Federalists are sympathetic to Burr because they themselves have plotted to withdraw New England from the Union. They charge that Federalists in general have seized on this Burr trial as an opportunity to embarrass the Jefferson administration. Now, it's clear from the jurors' own statements in court that they are predominantly Democratic Republicans, and as such, they must have backed President Jefferson against the Federalists in the struggle over ratifying the Louisiana Purchase 4 years ago. They might therefore be inclined to believe the charge that Burr tried to steal the Louisiana Territory, which would have cut off the Mississippi for American commerce, and that Burr also plotted with England in that very connection. Well, in any case, all this has led to such an intense popular feeling against Burr that for 2 weeks, it was just about impossible to assemble an unbiased jury. It was Colonel Burr himself who finally broke the deadlock by declaring he would take his chances even with a jury of manifest Democratic Republican leanings. Now here, by tape recording, is the statement Aaron Burr made to the court on August 15th.
Your Honor, I'm under the necessity of taking men in some degree prejudiced against me, or of having a fourth panel of prospective jurors called. I'm unwilling to submit to the delay of another panel, and so I accept the consequences. I hope the jury will do me justice.
Now, on the basis of all this, is it likely that the jurors will accept Justice Marshall's opinion of the law and acquit Aaron Burr, or will the jury bring back a verdict of guilty? This is Quincy Howe returning you to the courtroom at the Hall of Delegates and John Daly.
The jury returned from their deliberations a few moments ago is already seated in the box, and Justice Marshall is on the bench. The spectators have reassembled. They're very quiet. They know that this is the moment that they and the entire country have been waiting for. Every seat is full, and the atmosphere of the courtroom is charged with excitement and tension. Judge Marshall is leaning forward right now, whispering to the clerk of the court. As always, there is a slight delay as the scene is set for the dramatic moment of a trial, the handing down of a verdict by the jury. Now the clerk has left the bench, is walking toward the jury box, and in a moment, we'll know whether Aaron Burr is to be found guilty of treason and sentenced to hang,
gentlemen,
or the clerk is speaking.
Have you reached a unanimous verdict?
Aye.
How do you find?
We of the jury say that from the evidence submitted to us under this indictment, Aaron Burr is not proved to have committed treason. We therefore find him not guilty.
Not guilty. The jury has acquitted Aaron Burr. Colonel Burr is standing triumphantly in the prisoner's box, and pandemonium has broken loose among the spectators. Most of them are very obviously bitterly disappointed. However, some friends are rushing up to Colonel Burr and the defense lawyers, congratulating them on their victory. Considering the bitterness that we have seen here in this courtroom, this is sure to be regarded by many people as a triumph for American justice. When a man so widely supposed to be a traitor, in the midst of political rancor, sometimes bordering on hysteria, can be acquitted in a court of law. However, we call your attention to the odd phrasing of the verdict. It seems to indicate that the jurors themselves may still have some reservations about Colonel Burr's innocence. If they do, they have suppressed their own feelings and accepted Judge Marshall's interpretation of the law.
September 1st, 1807. Aaron Burr is acquitted of the charge of treason, and a precedent for the American concept of justice is established.
You have been listening to the trial of Aaron Burr in the series You Are There. The trial of Aaron Burr was written by Michael Sklar, directed by John Dietz, and produced by the CBS Documentary Unit under the supervision of Werner Michel. Aaron Burr was played by Martin Gable. Charles Webster was Justice John Marshall. Eric Dressler was Andrew Jackson. James Goss, Luther Martin. Paul Mann was U.S. Attorney Hay. Others in the cast included Agnes Young, Guy Sorrell, and Bert Cowlin. Beginning with this broadcast, You Are There will be heard every fourth Sunday at this time. Listen on November 27th, 4 weeks from today, over many of these same stations. Next month,
1830, Baltimore, Maryland. The race between the first American locomotive and a horse-drawn carriage. You are there.
When you keep your appointment with Dr. Christian, you keep an appointment with humor, drama, pathos, and real people living real lives in a typical small American town. Every Wednesday night, Dr. Christian, the kindly small-town physician, uses humor and horse sense as often as medicine to heal the troubles of his friends and neighbors. For stories that the whole family will enjoy, hear Dr. Christian this Wednesday night on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, and this fall, you'll hear them all on the Columbia Broadcasting System.